From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Yes, I'm Ariel Dorfman. I'm thinking about what happens when corporations have to look directly into the face of those things that they do.
Today, Ariel Dorfman on Blake's Therapy, Pinochet, and Kissinger. Also, what do the U.S. military and the Lutheran Church have in common? We'll talk to a gay military psychiatrist who was discharged and the son of a Lutheran bishop who's just been forced to resign after ordaining a lesbian for the first time ever. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Lawyers for Timothy McVeigh are asking a judge to delay his June 11th execution, accusing the government of withholding evidence in a so-called fraud upon the court that denied him a fair trial. Federal Judge Richard Mach in Denver has scheduled a hearing for Wednesday. Meantime, the Justice Department has turned over to McVeigh's defense team a report by a former FBI agent who alleges the government hadn't disclosed evidence he gathered that could have helped McVeigh. USA Today is reporting that a probe of racial bias in the federal death penalty system has stalled 5 months after Justice Department officials met with experts from across the country to begin the research. The experts' review was to have followed an internal review of death penalty cases by the Justice Department, but some experts who were to be involved in the broader review now say they believe that John Ashcroft's department either has held it up or abandoned it altogether. If the broader review were dropped, death penalty analysts say, it would raise questions about Ashcroft's desire for a detailed examination of the fairness of a system in which 80% of the federal cases eligible for the death penalty involve minority defendants. President Clinton had cited the need for a comprehensive federal view of the death penalty in December when he postponed the execution of Texas prisoner Juan Raul Garza, scheduled to be executed, the first federal inmate to be executed in 38 years on June 19th. Garza's attorneys have asked President Bush for clemency. They say the government's decision to seek the death penalty against him under U.S. drug kingpin laws might have been based on the Latino prisoner's ethnicity. The Justice Department's internal report, sources say, will not call for a moratorium on federal executions, as some critics have urged. In San Francisco, a federal appeals court has blocked the logging of thousands of acres of old-growth forest in Oregon, ruling the federal government did not adequately address the impact of logging on the environment. The sweeping decision Thursday also may halt proposed logging of hundreds of thousands of acres throughout California, Oregon, Washington State, all idled pending the ruling. The appellate panel said the National Marine Fisheries Service failed to adequately consider the harm logging would have on endangered salmon runs on federal land in the Umpqua Basin around Roseburg, Oregon. This international news: in Algeria, 200,000 Berbers have taken to the streets of Algiers to protest the killing of scores of demonstrators in the Berber-speaking Kabylie region. The opposition Socialist Forces Front called the rally in protest at the bloody crackdown by paramilitary police on unrest in Kabylie a stronghold of the party. 10 days ago, at least 500,000 joined a similar protest in the main Berber-speaking city to demand the withdrawal of all paramilitary police from Kabylie. The region has been raging with violent protests since a teenager held at a gendarmerie barracks was killed on April 18th. Up to 80 protesters have been killed by security forces, according to independent newspapers. Algeria plunged into brutal civil strife after the authorities' decision in 1992 to cancel a general election in which Islamists had taken a commanding lead. The 12-year-old boy whose plight dramatized the AIDS epidemic in South Africa has died in his sleep. And Kosi Johnson had been praised by Nelson Mandela as an icon in the struggle against HIV/AIDS. And Kosi will be remembered for a speech he made at the World AIDS Conference in Durban last July. He told delegates, "You can't get AIDS by hugging, kissing, holding hands. We are normal human beings. We can walk. We can talk." And Kosi was born with HIV and was the longest surviving child born with the virus in the country, where one in nine people are HIV positive. And African rights activists said Thursday they would press a world conference against racism to declare slavery and colonialism a double holocaust and would call for compensation from former colonial powers. Speaking for African non-governmental organizations, a spokesperson from Senegal said the impact of colonialism was one of the prime causes of Africa's economic backwardness today. International non-governmental organizations are meeting in Geneva to prepare a common position to take to a United Nations World Conference against racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance to be held in Durban, South Africa from August 31st to September 7th. In Buenos Aires, the leader of one of Argentina's most powerful unions has called for a national strike next week to protest the government's economic austerity measures. Hugo Moyano, head of a breakaway faction of the General Workers Confederation, said the 24-hour strike would be held June 8th to declare war against unemployment, which has reached 14.7% in Argentina. Renewed calls for a strike after the economy minister said the government would cut $900 million in spending, including $450 million in social services.
That falls, gonna get to know me enough to love me. I was lost in such inscrutable thought. Come step into the holy circle. That's the simple little answer I got. I step into the holy circle. I find friends waiting for me. I step into the holy circle. I get wise and I get free. All my life I was meant to be there. All my life I had turned away. I stepped into the holy circle. Goodbye, lonely yesterday. Would you really like to drive yourself crazy? Here's a very easy way to do it, my friend. Find the one thing you're bound to fail at, and you do it over and over again. There is help, but you got to ask for it. How come I could never figure that out? I step into the holy circle. That's the ticket they were talking about. I step into the holy circle. I find friends waiting for me. I step into the holy circle. I get wise and I get free. All my life I was meant to be there. All my life I had turned away. I step into the holy circle. Goodbye, lonely yesterday.
Step inside the holy circle from Inside Out by Charlie King. Here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio, I'm Amy Goodman. This week in San Francisco, a U.S. District Court judge ruled that former Air Force captain and psychiatrist John Hensala owes the U.S. Air Force more than $71,000 for his education because he failed to fulfill his military service obligation. He was automatically discharged in 1994 under the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy when he told the Air Force that he is gay. He was prevented from serving and then told he must pay the government back for his medical education at Northwestern University. The judge contends that John Hensala sought to avoid military service by admitting he was gay shortly before he was to begin his active duty, a charge that Hensala denies. He's the 24th case in which the Air Force has ordered discharge airmen to reimburse the government for their education after coming out. The case of John Hensala has once again cast a spotlight on the contradictions and consequences of the military's policy of preventing gays and lesbians from serving openly in the armed forces, consequences that Hensala, a psychiatrist, understands all too well. And he joins us on the telephone right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
So tell us your story.
Well, I entered the Air Force back in 1986 when I was finishing college, and that was for the training program for medical school. I didn't realize I was gay at the time. I identified as heterosexual and told them that truthfully. I only came out after, fully came out after I finished medical school, and when it was time to begin my active duty service in 1995. Prior to that, in late 1994, I wrote them a letter telling them I felt it was important I be open and honest about it, because I felt that that was important. I at that point in my life, I was out to people I knew, and I didn't feel there was a way I could really do my job with integrity if I weren't honest about that fact.
And so when did you decide to come forward?
That was in late 1994. I had done quite a bit of soul searching and decided in December of 1994 that it was important that I write them a letter. And the letter stated that I was gay and that it would not affect my ability in any way to be a good child psychiatrist for them.
Why did you feel that it was important to be honest?
Well, I really didn't see any other way to be at that point, to really, you know, the principles of my profession are that it's important to be true to oneself, and I didn't feel that I could be a psychiatrist and help people toward greater mental health in the Air Force in any way by being in the closet. I felt that it was important not to be, and, you know, for my own integrity and for the integrity of my profession.
What was it like to be in the closet in the military?
Well, I wrote the letter prior to entering active duty, and it was because in my life during training I had gotten to the point where I was not in the closet, and I didn't feel like I could go back into the closet to begin the active duty service with the Air Force.
And then your reaction today to the court ruling that... Well, they're really upholding the military and the don't ask, don't tell policy.
Yeah, well, I'm very disappointed. You know, when one really looks at the facts in my case, I think the decision is wrong.
How did you decide to take this to court, take the military to court?
Well, you know, it was really a matter of principle, and I filed the lawsuit on the principle of the matter because I thought it was... disappointing and outrageous enough when they discharged me, but the further decision for them to seek recoupment of the funds for the education was like a second blow, and I really felt that it was important to take a stand.
We're talking to Dr. John Hensela, who filed suit against the government, saying he wants to serve his country, should not be obliged to pay the government back. Did you find any sympathetic ears within the military, within the Air Force?
Not within the Air Force itself, but, you know, with the amount of attention that this case has generated, I have to say there have been there's been a lot of sympathy from across the country, from groups within the gay and lesbian community here in my hometown of San Francisco, and I've gotten a lot of calls from people nationwide and even from other parts of the world.
In addition to Dr. John Hensela, psychiatrist and former Air Force captain, now in private practice, Clyde Wadsworth is with us, who is Dr. Hensela's attorney. Clyde Wadsworth, can you put Dr. Hensela's case in a broader national context? How many cases like these are there?
Well, we're not entirely sure, but during the course of this litigation, the Air Force told the court that in the last 5 years there have been 30 similar cases in which what's called recoupment, that's an order by the Air Force to repay medical education expenses, that there have been 30 such cases in the last 5 years, and that in all but three of them the Air Force has ordered recoupment. So in our view, the Air Force applies a discriminatory recoupment standard to service members who are discharged for disclosing they are gay. And this decision effectively permits the Air Force to continue applying that discriminatory standard. We believe the court's decision is wrong, and we intend to appeal it to the Federal Appeals Court.
You say in all but several of those cases, the military has won on getting those whose education is paid for the military to pay them back. What about the cases where they weren't forced to pay back?
Well, part of the problem with this case is that the judge dismissed Dr. Hensler's case before we had any opportunity to conduct discovery, which is the usual process in civil litigation where you're able to gather information from the opposing side and depose the relevant witnesses under oath. We weren't able to do any of that in this case. All we got was what the Air Force wanted us to get. So according to the Air Force, we know that there are not several but only three cases in which they haven't ordered recoupment, and we know very little about those cases. We know that that in one of them, every Air Force body that considered the case recommended recoupment even in that case, and this was in the case of a person who was outed by someone else. And in that case, only when it got to the Secretary of the Air Force was there a decision made not to order recoupment with no explanation. It's our position, though, just based on the 24 other cases, that there's a discriminatory standard that's applied and that this policy disproportionately targets gay service members for findings that they voluntarily failed to complete their obligations. There's no similar category of recoupment cases, as they're called, in which the Air Force finds that service members purposefully try to avoid their service obligations. And we hope that the public, as a result of this case, that the public in general and Congress in particular will recognize the unjust result in this case as an opportunity to reevaluate not only the Air Force's recoupment policy, but also the discriminatory don't ask, don't tell policy. You know, the military purports to need talented people like Dr. Hensler, but refuse to use his talents and their own investment in his education simply because he's gay. And that's the real waste of taxpayer dollars here.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. John Hensler, would you do it any other way?
You know, I think this was an important stand to have taken, and no, I wouldn't have.
Dr. John Hensler, psychiatrist and former Air Force captain, now in private practice. Again, a U.S. District Court judge in San Francisco has ruled that the former Air Force captain and psychiatrist owes the U.S. Air Force more than $71,000 for his education because he didn't fulfill his military service obligation. He was automatically discharged in 1994 under the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. The military said that given that policy, he should have known that he would have been discharged if he publicly said he was gay. And because he did that and was forced out, he would have to repay the military for his education. Clyde Wadsworth, also with us, the attorney for John Hensler. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move on to a related issue, and that is that after admitting he'd engaged in an act of ecclesiastical disobedience by participating in the ordination of a lesbian, Bishop Paul Egertsen today officially announces his resignation from the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. In an open letter to the ministers and synod council members of his Southern California West Synod, Bishop Egertsen wrote, "Yesterday, Shirley and I celebrated our 45th wedding anniversary. Within our first year of marriage, God gave us our first son. He was and is a gift. He was and is gay. Over the next 15 years, God gave us 5 more sons. They were and are gifts. They are straight. You never know what is in God's gifts until you open them. We have been blessed, and we are grateful." At the invitation of St. Paul Reformation Lutheran Church, St. Paul, and by its authorization, he wrote, "I participated, along with others, in the irregular ordination of Anita Hill. Among other things, that event was an act of ecclesiastical disobedience, protesting the ELCA's policy of precluding gay and lesbian people in committed relationships from ordination." Bishop Egertsen went on to say, "Early in the week following the ordination, the Executive Committee of the Conference of Bishops met, and our presiding bishop, H. George Anderson, phoned me to report the results of that meeting. They recalled a promise I'd made to the bishops at my first meeting with them, in which I said, if I ever found it necessary to act in accordance with my convictions about the role of gay and lesbian people in our church in a way that would violate the constitution or policy of this church, I would resign. Bishop Egertson is the first active bishop in the 5.1 million member denomination, the nation's largest Lutheran body, to join in the ordination of a non-celibate gay or lesbian. The church ordains gay men and lesbians only if they pledge to remain celibate. When we come back from our break, we'll be joined by Bishop Egertson's son, Greg, as well as Anita Hill, the woman that the bishop ordained as pastor of the St. Paul Reformation Lutheran Church. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. We're joined right now by Anita Hill, newly ordained pastor of the St. Paul Reformation Lutheran Church. She was ordained by Southern California Bishop Egertson last month. This was the first ever ordination of a non-celibate lesbian. We're also joined by Bishop Egertson's son, Greg Egertson, who Bishop Egertson referred to in his letter explaining why he would be resigning. Greg Egertson, what are your thoughts about your dad today?
Well, they're mixed. Certainly I'm very proud of him for the stand he's taken in support of gay and lesbian people over the years and for his willingness to put his own future on the line by participating in Anita's ordination. But I'm sad that he has been forced to resign because I think he's a brilliant man and really a prophet in our church on this issue. And it's kind of sad to see that he has to step down. I understand his reasons for it. If he hadn't made the promise to the bishops 6 years ago to gain their trust, he would not be resigning now. He would be standing up to face whatever other discipline that they would come back at him with.
Greg Egertson, you also are co-chair of the Lutheran Lesbian and Gay Ministries, and you went through the training process to join the ministry, but decided that you couldn't continue. Why?
Well, at the time I went through seminary, it was about 11 years ago, the church was just putting this policy in place that really requires a vow of celibacy from gay and lesbian pastors, and I simply wasn't willing to take that vow. And I was forced to choose between going on in the ministry or never having a partner or the possibility of entering into a committed relationship. And I thought that was kind of a cruel choice to put on people. And I wasn't willing to take the vow, so I wasn't able to proceed with ordination.
Are other Lutheran pastors, gay and lesbian pastors, required to take this oath of celibacy?
Yeah, everybody is required to take the vow. Some do, some don't. There are lots and lots of gay and lesbian pastors in our church who were either ordained and installed prior to this policy or who are just keeping quiet and kind of living in fear that they might be outed at some point.
So straight pastors are not required to take this vow?
Right, straight pastors are not required to take the vow.
Well, we're also joined on the telephone by Anita Hill, newly ordained pastor of the St. Paul Reformation Lutheran Church. Can you describe the ceremony last month that Bishop Egertson is now resigning over?
Thank Thank you, Amy. It was a wonderful celebration. We had over 1,100 people come together for the service of ordination, and Bishop Egertson, while the only bishop who is currently serving, was joined by three other bishops in retirement from the Evangelical Lutheran Church, and one a retired bishop who continues to hold his title from the Diocese of Stockholm in Sweden. And Paul Tiedemann, who's pastor of St. Paul Reformation Lutheran Church, presided at the service. So they all participated in that service together. And when it came time to participate in the laying on of hands during the service, they were joined by approximately 160 other Lutheran clergy who also came forward and laid on hands, as well as ecumenical clergy in that service. It was full of energy and excitement, and we thought we could have raised the roof that day. It seemed like the Spirit clearly was among us.
Is this just a U.S. policy for U.S. Lutheran bishops? You mentioned the Swedish retired bishop. He can remain that.
I know that there are, in other countries where Lutheranism is prevalent, there are varying decisions being made about gay and lesbian clergy, and I'm not certain of the policy in Stockholm particularly.
Anita Hill, can you talk about the struggle to gain the church's call for your ordination?
Yes, my call to ministry first was realized by myself and by the community that I was a part of in the late 1970s. I was in Ann Arbor, Michigan at the Lord of Light congregation at the University of Michigan campus. As I was coming out, I was finding myself a person of faith and lesbian, trying to figure out what all this meant, and it meant for years that I didn't pursue trying to have that call realized in terms of ordination and seeking the appropriate education to prepare myself for it. St. Paul Reformation Lutheran Church started a ministry with gay and lesbian people back in 1982. And I joined the staff in 83 and have been doing education in the Lutheran Church for years. Hundreds of what I call the Sunday morning Meet the Homosexual show, from church to church, trying to help people understand that gay people are just human beings too, people who love and love one another and should not face any retribution from the church because they express that love and committed relationship with one another. So I've had a long history of being involved with this congregation, which is now 118 years old. And in 1994, the congregation revamped its long-range plan and hoped to have an openly gay pastor serving by the year 2000. And I joined in a teamed ministry then with our ordained pastor and have been doing serving in a pastoral function since 1994 and completed my seminary education just last spring in May of 2000.
Why do you want to be part of a church that doesn't want you to freely practice who you are?
Well, I guess I wouldn't quite phrase the question that way. Why do I want to continue to be a part of a church that speaks of grace, that speaks of love, and understands itself to be gospel-driven, I think is how I might go at it a little differently, to say that I would hope that no gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender person would ever be asked to leave the tradition in which they find home in order to realize their call and to serve as an ordained pastor. So it's been a matter of justice in some regard to work with the church to try to help it broaden its own view to be one that's more inclusive and welcoming of gay and lesbian people.
Can you talk about the two people in San Francisco that began the struggle for the acceptance of gay men and lesbians as pastors in the Lutheran ministries?
In 1990, there were two congregations, First United Lutheran Church and St. Francis Lutheran Church in San Francisco. And the two of them came together to form Lutheran Lesbian and Gay Ministry, and they called at that time Jeff Johnson and Ruth Frost and Phyllis Zillhart, and the three of them were ordained in a service quite similar to this one, which has just occurred in January of 1990. As a result, those congregations were taken to disciplinary hearings within the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and they were placed on suspension for a period of 5 years, through which they had no representation at assemblies or other gatherings or any voice or vote. And at the end of that five-year period, because those pastors were still serving those congregations, the congregations were removed from the roster of Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and they're no longer recognized as part of the ELCA.
Finally, Greg Egertson, son of Bishop Egertson, who is formally announcing his resignation today. Do you think there would be any change of heart within the Lutheran Church allowing your father, Bishop Egertson, to remain?
I don't expect any change from the national churches in the national church's position on this. My father was set to retire at the end of July anyway. He had been planning that for years. So it's really kind of a symbolic resignation that they're requiring of him. He is meeting right now with his local assembly of congregations. They're in their annual conference this weekend, and that's where he'll be announcing his resignation this afternoon. I would kind of hope that they would make some gesture on his behalf and ask him to perhaps extend the resignation 1 month to coincide with his retirement. But I don't really see that happening. What I see, though, is that this is still a major step forward for us because it's the first time that one of our national leaders has really put his future on the line in opposition to this policy. And that will encourage others to do the same. There's a lot of support for gay and lesbian clergy within our church and even at the highest levels. But up until now, nobody has been willing to break ranks and go public with putting their own future on the line. And now that that silence has been broken, I think we'll see some changes over in the next few years.
If people want to find out more about the story of your father and your own organization, Lutheran Lesbian and Gay Ministries, where can they go on the web?
They can check the LLGM, that's Lutheran Lesbian and Gay Ministries website, www.llgm.org. All the information should be there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We also found on the web at www.socal, I guess Southern California Synod.org, your father, Bishop Egertson's open letter. And Anita Hill, thanks also for being with us, newly ordained pastor of the St. Paul Reformation Lutheran Church. I know there's a documentary about your story produced by Pam Walton called Call to Witness, telling the stories of Reverend Steve Sabin in Iowa, who was outed by his bishop, supported by his congregation, and tried by the National Church because he refused to resign, and Reverend Jane Ralph in Missouri, who was forced out of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America with no process for recourse, as well as your own story, Anita Hill in Minnesota, just ordained as an openly lesbian pastor in the year 2001. That documentary is going to be aired soon in Los Angeles. I want to thank you all for being with us in Gay History Month.
Was a bashful kid, grew up on Nashville, dreamed of the smoky old west. His dad's a straight shooter, told Wayne a recruiter would help him put hair on his chest. Signed up for Fort Benning, he liked all the men, he made friends with a shake and a grin. Met the men he liked most at a bar off the post. It's the first place Wayne ever fit in. But the neon sign over the bar hung under the howitzer shell flashed the saddest words Wayne ever saw. Don't ask, don't tell.
Don't ask, don't tell, from Charlie King's CD, Inside Out. It's Gay Pride Month, and we here at Democracy Now! Celebrate Gay Pride Month by talking to gay men and lesbians who are making history. We're going to move on now to our continued Art and Revolution series. we're joined by Ariel Dorfman. Detectives and police paid a visit to former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger on Monday night at the Ritz Hotel in Paris. In a summons translated aloud by the hotel manager, they asked if Kissinger would help the French judge, Roger Laloire, with his investigation of the murder of five French youths by the Pinochet regime in Chile in the 1970s. Kissinger ignored the summons, saying later he was too busy. Judge Laloire is investigating the disappearance and presumed murder of the five young French residents of Chile in response to a formal complaint by the families. He's also investigating whether their fate was connected to Operation Condor, a concerted drive by several Latin American governments to suppress left-wing opponents and their sympathizers. Recently declassified CIA documents indicate that the U.S. administration at the time, in which Henry Kissinger was Secretary of State, knew at least the broad outlines of the Condor plan. Also on Monday, a Chilean Court of Appeal ruled that General Pinochet, indicted last January, was not exempt from normal criminal procedures before trial. Pinochet is accused of ordering what's come to be known as the Caravan of Death and of covering up the murder and kidnapping of 75 people in the weeks after the coup that brought him to power in September 73. Ariel Dorfman joins us now in the studio, exiled Chilean novelist, playwright, and activist. He was born in Argentina in 1942, attended grade school in New York City, then moved to Chile, where he became a citizen. There, he became a close ally of President Salvador Allende. Dorfman was forced to leave the country in 1974 after the coup, 1973 after the coup. He's written extensively about General Pinochet and his brutal regime, has also written numerous plays, books, and short stories, including Death and the Maiden, Speak Truth to Power, Voices from Beyond the Dark. And recently, he delivered the keynote address at the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil. He's currently a professor at Duke University, and he's just come out with his latest book called Blake's Therapy, which we're also going to be talking about. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ariel Dorfman.
I'm very glad to be in any place where there's some Democracy Now!
Well, let's start with the connections between Kissinger and Pinochet. This is a story you have lived yourself.
You know, General Pinochet is a creature of our own mistakes in Chile, but he's also a creature of the imaginings of the American policy and political establishment. So in that sense, though he's a bit older than Kissinger, I would say that Pinochet is one of Kissinger's children. Kissinger helped to imagine him, helped to create the conditions that brought him into power, and then kept him in power for many, many years. And in fact, there are things that we know now, not from his own memoirs, of course, but basically from declassified information and notes, that Kissinger said to Pinochet, you know what, I'm going to try to have to be hard on you, but just don't listen to me. It doesn't matter. It's just for the gallery, basically. I'm just saying this out loud publicly, but just keep on doing your good job.
What did you think when you heard about the French judge wanting to question Kissinger? This is something Kissinger apparently has been very concerned about all over the world, checking with the State Department when he wants to go on an overseas trip to make sure that this very thing would not happen.
Well, it's interesting to think that he was too busy to find out where, how he could help to find out what had happened to five French youngsters who are desaparecidos and therefore presumably, and we have no doubt whatsoever, that they were assassinated, right? So he has no time for those five people. But, of course, he had a lot of time for Chile when he was in the White House and when he was thinking about how to destabilize my country. You know, this program is called Democracy Now!, and we have to always remember the fact that we had a democratic regime in Chile. It wanted to go to socialism through democratic means. The United States, which calls itself a democracy, destabilized and engineered the coup against our government. I'm not trying, you know, to whitewash whatever errors we may have made in that sense, but the United States had nothing whatsoever to do. In other words, it was not their business to go around, as Kissinger said, to meddle with what our people had decided. We had decided through the votes to do certain things. He decided with his one vote on the National Security Council and in the Nixon and then the Ford White House to destabilize our country.
What was Kissinger's famous quote?
Well, I mean, he says we're not going to allow a country to go communist due to the irresponsibility of its people. Well, I mean, you know, I would say that Kissinger should not be allowed to have a good night's sleep due to the responsibility of his conscience.
Well, he went on to Italy. He was on a private visit to France.
Well, he should go on to Italy, but there are Italians who have also been assassinated by the Pinochet regime. Maybe the Italians will do it as well. I mean, the thing is, he should be able to face the fact that he is the intellectual author of many of these terrible crimes. I'm not sure exactly what sort of trial could be done, because if you have a trial of Kissinger, you're probably going to have to put on trial most of the people who are in most of the governments of the world. But I think it's very important to bring this to the forefront of the world consciousness, of the fact that there are people who sit in their rooms and decide the fate of millions and then go about their lives very, very cheerfully. I mean, in fact, my latest novel is about that, but it's not about Kissinger, of course, at all.
We're going to talk about your latest novel when we come back. Ariel Dorfman is our guest, and his latest book is called Blake's Therapy. He was a citizen of Chile, a close ally of Salvador Allende, and I do want to ask you one last question on that, to make these stories that are not just stories, but very real events. I think what happens these days is people identify with the living person. You know, Henry Kissinger is a person. They may know his story. What they don't know are the stories of the people in another country who are not here today, perhaps because of someone like Henry Kissinger. We'll come back in a second, in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman, here with writer, author, activist, poet Ariel Dorfman. His latest book is called Blake's Therapy, The Caravan of Death.
Well, Pinochet took power, and when he took power, one of the first acts he did was to bomb the presidential palace, which was a way in which he was signifying to the world and to Chile that he was willing to destroy our White House. And if he was willing to do that, he was willing to do anything. And around a month and a half after he took power, a series of generals in the north of the country had already put people on trial, sentenced them, you know, people who had been Allende supporters, sentenced them and basically put them in jail, you know, short sentences, three months, things like that. He sent a general on a mission, and the mission was to get rid of these people. I mean, this is written on his own handwriting. He wrote that in that sense. And the generals who went on that mission have accused him of having been the person who sent them on that mission and having covered it up afterwards. And what they did is these people who had already been sentenced were taken out of the jails. They were taken away from where they were, already, you know, taken care of in some sense, and they were executed. Before they were executed, terrible things happened to them. This has been, you know, told by the generals and by people who were there. Their eyes were gouged out. Their genitals were, you know, cut off. All sorts of horrible things happened to them. And this is called the Caravan of Death because it began in the north, and then the helicopter would go to the next town, and then more people would be killed. And there are 75 people of those who are the missing people among those. Those people whose bodies were either buried in the desert or thrown out to sea, etc. So these people who were executed was called La Caravana de la Muerte, the Caravan of Death. And it is for this that he is indicted. He is accused of many, many other things, but this is the specific indictment that has him at this moment about to stand trial in Chile, about to be fingerprinted in Chile.
Why did Kissinger care about Chile at that time? Kissinger
before,
and Nixon.
Before. Well, you know, Allende was, this was, you've got to remember, this was the 1970s, where you had a Cuban revolution that was very, very strong. There were many movements towards a sort of a democratic left-wing or liberationist theory in all over Latin America. And Chile was the first country that had a left-wing president that had been elected through the ballot box and not through the bullets, you know. So there was an example there of structural change. But especially from the point of view, I think the thing that most worried Nixon and Kissinger was the Allende doctrine of nationalization of U.S. property. One of the theories that Allende expounded was the following. We are going to expropriate this because it belongs to the nation, the copper mines that you people have got, the electrical companies that you've got, the telephone companies, some of the banks. And we're going to pay you back. But before we pay you back, we're going to deduct all the excessive earnings and profits that you've taken from our country. Let's say if you took 500% profit one year, you know what? We're going to take 300% of that profit, and we're going to deduct it from the sum that was paid for this. Now, that is absolutely intolerable for the world economic system. And I think that's the basic thing that did him in. But, you know, there were other reasons, geopolitical reasons of another sort.
And
as
what
well.
Was your connection to Allende?
Well, you know, I mean, I in Heading South, Looking North, my memoir, I've spoken about that. I was not a friend of his. I was a kid, really. I was young. I was under 30. But towards, I mean, for me, he was like a father figure in some sense. You know, he was a person who was indicating a way out of poverty and injustice with democratic means, with tolerance, with nonviolence, which I think is a very, very important thing. It brings together the two things that I care about, which is democracy and social justice. And I ended up, due to reasons that are explained in my book, I mean, I ended up in the Moneda, the last two months before the coup, almost purposefully putting myself in the way of harm. In other words, almost as if I said, I don't want to survive a coup if it comes. And only because of very strange circumstances am I alive today. The reason why, perhaps because I care so much about all of this, you know, several of my friends were killed in the Caravan of Death. I have not been able to go to their tombs. I don't know where they're buried. In other words, I know they're dead, but... And one of my friends who was not in the Caravan of Death was in the Moneda, Claudio Jimeno.
The palace.
In the palace, you know, the palace, the presidential palace. And it turns out that I switched sides with him. I switched turns with him. I should have been there on September 10th in 1973.
Doing what?
The night guard. And so the telephone would have rung, and they would have said, the Navy has disembarked in Valparaiso. The coup is on. Please tell the president. I would have put down the phone. I would have picked up another phone and called Allende and said, Mr. President, the military have taken power, have begun to take power. I wasn't there for reasons that I can't really, I don't want to go into now because it's just written in this Heading South, Looking North book, which is now available also in Spanish here, Rumbo al Sur, Desciendo al Norte. So it was a very special moment for me.
Before we go into Blake's Therapy, your latest novel, which is a powerful look at, artistic look at, political look at corporate globalization, really, I wanted to ask you one quick related question, and that has to do with Bob Kerrey, the former senator of Nebraska, and his admission, forced admission, because of a CBS New York Times expose that he was involved in the massacre of Vietnamese civilians more than three decades ago.
Well, you know, I come to this from a very different perspective than most North Americans, having been myself a very big opponent of the war, of course. I was here in Berkeley in 1968 and 1969. I come to it from the perspective of somebody who has lived among people who are accomplices of terrible things or spectators of terrible things. And I've discovered that we ourselves are in some ways responsible for what people say or do not say about the past. As I've spent a great part of my life, you know, Death and the Maiden. My work deals with these problems of what we do with the terror that has been inflicted upon us, but what we do if we have inflicted terror on others. I just want to put this at the perspective from which I come. And I wrote a piece in the L.A. Times basically saying, where were the American people on the night when Bob Kerry and his men were murdering those Vietnamese in that hut? And then I go on saying, I mean, where were they during the 32 years since? I'm not exonerating him at all, because he has to be held accountable, just like Milosevic has to be held accountable, just like Pinochet has to be held accountable, just like Kissinger has to be held accountable, right? I mean, I think it's very important to find out who did it, why it was done. You know, establish the truth. That's very important. But I'm very worried about the idea that he was not alone. In some sense, why did it take 32 years for him to speak? It isn't only because he didn't want it known. A terrible crime, of course, you hide it. But it's that I think that too many people in America wanted the crime hidden. They didn't want to look at it. They didn't want to face this directly, the problem. What they wanted to do is what we've been doing in Chile, or trying to do in Chile, which is let's sweep it under the carpet. Let's put it in a room by itself like some sort of mad, crazy relative, you know, a horrible person who we want to look to, sort of the cretin of the family or the, you know that skeleton in the closet. But the skeleton in the closet exists. So it comes out. And I finished my article by saying that it's not a question I only ask of Bob Kerry or the American people. I ask it of myself as well. Because, and I end up by saying, look, you know, a very short time ago, there was Rwanda. So you hear 100,000 people have been killed. 2 weeks later, you hear that 200,000 people have been killed. A week later, you hear that 500,000 people have been killed. By the time it was July 1994, I think, 1 million people have been killed in Africa. And I finished my article on Bob Kerry saying, why didn't I care? So I say, you know, Bob Kerry wasn't alone after all in that hut in Vietnam. I mean, we were all in it, in a sense. So you have to ask yourself, and ask yourself what he did, but also ask yourself, what did you do to make sure that Bob Kerry did speak out, had a world where speaking out about these things was important? And I think that people like Bob Kerry and people like the Vietnam vets, strangely enough, have a connection with death, ambiguity, and terror that might be good for some Americans to listen to. Because this is a nation, not most of the people who listen to this program, but people who probably don't listen to this program. It's a connection, it's a nation of sort of innocence, or who want to consider themselves innocent. And Americans are, like everybody else, part of both the wonders and the terrors of the world.
We're talking to Ariel Dorfman. Yesterday, a German film crew came here doing a documentary on Kissinger, and they were talking to me about Kissinger in East Timor, and they asked if I thought that Kissinger would ever be called before a war crimes tribunal. Do you think Kissinger, perhaps Kerry, will ever be held accountable?
Well, I think we should really certainly separate Kerry from Kissinger. I mean, but let's speak about Kissinger only in this case, okay? I'm totally convinced that he will never stand trial. The only trial that Kissinger can face is the trial in the court of public opinion, which is, I think, perhaps more important. Because symbolically, it's very important to punish people who have done certain things. It's very difficult to say that he was directly responsible in a criminal way for this. I mean, certainly Christopher Hitchens considers that is so. And it would have to be the fact of, I mean, I think it's very important that the people of a country should hold their government accountable for the crimes that government commits. There should be no statute of limitations on that. I don't think it's going to happen. But I think the most important thing of all, when something terrible has been done, such as it was done by Kissinger in Chile, in Cambodia, in Cyprus, and in so many other places around the world, what really matters is don't do it again. I mean, you cannot resurrect the dead. You can make sure that those who died leave us a lesson so that we do not continue killing and intervening and doing things again. So what I think is really important about the Kissinger trial, quote unquote, is let's learn some lessons from that. I certainly would hope that that would come out of this.
But you wouldn't say that about, you know, your typical common murderer. Hope we learn that people shouldn't murder. Why do you give up so quickly on him being found accountable? In standard criminal law, we don't just say it's about lessons. We say it's about someone being punished as an example to others.
I'm not saying it's not going to happen. I'm just I'm not saying that he shouldn't be put on trial, which is something which lawyers should decide, and we'll find out how that's going to happen. I'm just saying that that is not what I think is going to happen, and I think it's a very complicated issue to discover when somebody is the intellectual person behind a crime or when the person is a person who pulls the trigger. You know, in the case of somebody who pulls the trigger, there's that. You know, the differentiation between the person who works the policy out, the person who gives the order, the person who creates and diagnoses the situation, the person who then tells another person to do it, the person who gives another order, and then the person who pulls the trigger, there's a whole chain of command.
Right.
What we need to do is to break that down in the modern world. We have to understand that certain people are held accountable. Now, war crimes, it turns out that under the Nuremberg trials, it's very possible that Kissinger could be tried. I doubt that will happen.
And in common criminal law, that person who's the architect is also charged with murder. But
you have to prove it.
Yeah, you have to prove it.
That he wanted to do precisely that murder. In other words, you don't speak about generalities. You speak about one person in particular. So you have to link Kissinger to one person in particular who has been murdered because he wanted that very person murdered, right? I mean, it's a very complicated thing. I don't think it's going to happen. This is not the popular thing to say on WBAI, you know, or on
well,
on
unfortunately, you're not saying it on WBAI because we're not broadcasting it.
Okay,
today,
I mean, anyway, it's not popular to be saying this up on the Pacifica listeners because we would all, you know, I think Kissinger is one of the most detestable characters that I've ever seen because he's so full of self-satisfaction. You know, it's what I dislike particularly about him is that he's so proud about having caused so much suffering. But he, you know, he thinks that he did it for a very good cause. He would defend himself rather brilliantly, I think.
Ariel Dorfman, we only have a minute, and this is going to be a two-part interview. We're going to play the second part of this interview on Monday. But in this minute remaining, speaking of conscience, and to give us a preview of what we'll be talking about on Monday, your latest book, Blake's Therapy, you explore not the conscience of a military commander or head of state, but of a CEO of a global corporation. Just give us a tease about what we're going to be talking about.
What I wanted to do is I wanted to take a somebody who has enormous power. In fact, some of these CEOs have much more power than a Kissinger or a Pinochet. But, of course, the ways in which they exercise their power has very little to do directly with human rights violations. It has to do with economic realities. And I wanted to take a very good, generous CEO, sort of the best I could think of, and put him in the experimental situation where he goes into a mental crisis and he has to manipulate a real family and either cause them suffering, have them become a great success, or destroy them. So I wanted to put him face to face with the suffering or the reality of what he could inflict upon them. It's an experiment. It's a narrative. It's a novel about global power, but also about sex and about other things as well.
And we're going to talk about that on Monday on Democracy Now! In our continued Art and Revolution series. Ariel Dorfman, author, poet, activist, went to the Davos World Economic Forum and the World Social Forum, gave a keynote address in Brazil, and we're going to talk about that as well. Corporate globalization and fiction. And nonfiction as well. So that's all coming up on Monday. Stay tuned. Blake's Therapy is Ariel Dorfman's latest novel. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony 1857 Sloan is our engineer. If you'd like to write to us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. From the embattled sub-studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!